production, the overall budget was set to top $100 million. By this point, the summer of 2011, Lowe and his allies had taken control of almost $2 billion from 1MDB. But much of that had been spent on mansions, hotels, gambling, and partying, as well as to pay off conspirators. Lowe needed new deals, both to plug the hole at 1MDB and to give him the financial muscle to dominate in Hollywood. His relations with PetroSaudi fraying, the Malaysian looked around for other partners. Distracted and always on the move, he didn't seem willing to put in the legwork to pull off a complicated acquisition, such as the plan to buy the U.S. oil refinery that Patrick Mahoney had pushed. He lacked Mahoney's banking skills and had no ability to value companies in the oil and gas sector. Lowe wanted to quickly flip assets and forge alliances with partners who could help him make a fast dollar. Around this time, Lowe read a news story about a battle to take over a group of hotels that included London's famed Claridge's. One of the bidding groups included a wealthy British property magnate called Robert Cengiz. The 50-year-old had salt-and-pepper hair, which descended in waves to his shoulders, and he was often seen in white shirts with a few buttons undone. Talking in a deep, gravelly voice, Cengiz hailed from an Iraqi Jewish family that had moved to Iran and later settled in London after being driven out during the Islamic Revolution. He was always involved in some property deal or another, and his latest was a heated contest with the Barclays brothers, among Britain's wealthiest individuals, for control of Corowin Limited, which owned Claridge's. For his bid, Cengiz had teamed up with a Middle Eastern fund called Abar Investments. It was just the kind of acquisition that appealed to Lowe, a swanky hotel at the center of London's Mayfair district. The involvement of Abar was also an attraction. The fund was controlled by the International Petroleum Investment Company, or IPIC, a $70 billion sovereign wealth fund owned by the government of Abu Dhabi. Lowe had done business with Mubadala of Abu Dhabi, but he had yet to make contacts at IPIC, or Abar. The IPIC fund's managing director, a wealthy Arab businessman named Kadem Al-Kubaisi, had a reputation among financiers who did business with him for demanding kickbacks from deals. In the wake of the financial crisis, IPIC had been snapping up stakes in Western companies, Barclays Bank, Daimler-Benz, Virgin Galactic, and Al-Kubaisi had become a powerful figure in the emirate. Lowe wanted in on the deal, and he got to know Cengiz through a wealth advisor they both knew. At first, Cengiz did not consider Lowe a serious investor. Who had heard of Winton after all? But then, during discussions over the deal for Claridge's, Lowe provided a letter from 1MDB stating it would provide up to £1 billion in financing for the acquisition. "We didn't know 1MDB was a bullshit thing," Cengiz told friends later. "It appeared to be a government subsidiary, just like Abar. That's why we went partners with him." To show his seriousness, Lowe signed a check on the spot for £50 million, which he said could be used to start building a stake in Corowin. In the end, the shareholders of Corowin decided against the Winton-Abar offer. Still, it wasn't a wasted exercise. Through the deal-making, Lowe had made a new connection with Abar's chief executive, Mohammed Badawi al-Husseini, a U.S. citizen of Kenyan origin. A former accountant who went by Mo to friends, al-Husseini wore sharp suits and expensive watches. He was short and balding, but fit, with a penchant for the insanity workout routine, an interval training set that burned 1,000 calories an hour. He was Al-Kubaisi's right-hand man in Abar, and was known mostly for his obedience to the boss. Lowe began to invite al-Husseini to his star-studded parties, and the Abar chief executive took to Lowe's exclusive social milieu, boasting to friends about the celebrities he was meeting. If Lowe had started cultivating famous friends to quell some kind of lingering insecurity, or even for the sheer hell of it, he also came to realize it was good business. Many of his prospective partners were wowed by Lowe's familiarity with DiCaprio, Hilton, and others. His Hollywood friends gave him an edge over other investors looking for Middle East tie-ups. It wasn't long before Low and al-Husseini worked out a way for the entities they controlled to work together. In June 2011, Low brokered a deal for Abar to acquire a stake in a Malaysian bank, RHB, for which it paid $2.7 billion. Soon after, the bank's stock price fell sharply, and Abar was stuck with paper losses of hundreds of millions of dollars. Undeterred, 1MDB and Abar then set up a joint venture of their own, a fund intended to invest in commodity markets. And the first deal was for a stake in a Mongolian coal mine. That investment also performed badly when coal prices crashed as China's economy slowed. No matter, Low and al-Husseini personally prospered from the deal by arranging a multi-million dollar fee from the seller as a reward for bringing in Abar and 1MDB. When he found out about the losses, al-Kubaisi, the IPIC chief, was livid, and once again, Low needed another deal to placate an angry partner. To make it up, Low was hoping to involve his new Abu Dhabi friends in his biggest scheme yet, one that would leech even more cash out of 1MDB, helping to pay for DiCaprio, Scorsese, and the production budget of The Wolf of Wall Street. With his ambitious new collaborators, Low was moving on from 1MDB's original partner, Petro Saudi. But there was a dangerous divide at the company, one that threatened to bring the whole house of cards crashing down. Chapter 21. Bitter Severance. London, April 2011. The bar in the Connaught, a five-star hotel in London's Mayfair district, was an apt place for Xavier Giusto, an employee of Petro Saudi, to be discussing his severance deal with Patrick Mahoney. The place reeked of money, from the dark leather sofas to the cubist-inspired wood paneling and a Wedgwood-like molded plaster ceiling. Giusto, a muscled and extensively tattooed Mediterranean-looking man in his mid-40s, who at 6 feet 6 inches tall towered over most people, repeated his demand for 6.5 million Swiss francs. As head of Petro Saudi's London office, Giusto had worked on deals involving the oil drill ships that the Petro Saudi 1MDB joint venture acquired. Tarek Obaid, the firm's chief executive, was an old friend, and he had promised Giusto millions of dollars for opening the London office. But the money had never materialized, and Giusto had been left to personally cover some company expenses. He was there at the Connaught to try to get his money. Fearing a problem, Mahoney was keen to settle, but he haggled. The pair talked for some time, with Tarek Obaid on the phone with Mahoney at one point, and left the Connaught agreeing on 5 million Swiss francs. But Obaid later sought to lower the amount further. As Obaid saw it, he had been good to Giusto, and now his friend was being disloyal. Giusto was a Swiss citizen, born to Spanish immigrants, who had gotten to know Obaid in the 1990s. After working for a Swiss private bank, Obaid had set up businesses with Prince Turki, looking to pave the way for foreign investors in Saudi Arabia. He took a desk at a financial services company in Geneva, partly owned by Giusto. The pair became close, despite the decade difference in their ages. Giusto owned a share in a Geneva nightclub called the Platinum Club, but it made little money. When Obaid set up Petro Saudi, he persuaded his friend to become director of a number of the new firm's affiliates. Initially, Giusto had little to do. Petro Saudi's operations were more or less non-existent, and he went traveling in Asia. Obaid called him in 2010 with an offer. Petro Saudi had come into a lot of money, and he wanted Giusto to become director of the firm's London office. Offered a starting salary of £400,000 per year, with the chance to make millions, Giusto moved to London and ran Petro Saudi's sleek new offices in Curzon Street, only a 5-minute walk from the Connaught. Giusto helped with the only real business the 1MDB Petro Saudi joint venture ever conducted, two drill ships acquired by the company and then leased to Venezuela's National Oil Company, and was often on the plane to Caracas. But his relations with Obaid soon deteriorated, as his young friend seemed paranoid and arrogant after the 1MDB deal, while at the same time failing to deliver the proposed millions. Seemingly intoxicated by the extent of his newfound wealth, Obaid began flying to Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East on private jets and, like Low, renting yachts in the south of France. His brother suggested setting up a family office to manage all the money. To some observers, Obaid started to act erratically. He always had been a hypochondriac, complaining of vague illnesses, and after the money started flowing, he wrote to the Mayo Clinic in the United States to get a full medical checkup, despite being in his mid-30s. He began to party incessantly and put on weight. People who knew him said he flew into frequent rages. Patrick Mahoney also began to spend. His wife was pregnant with their first child, and in November 2009, Mahoney signed a deal to buy a 6.2 million pound townhouse overlooking a private park in London's Ladbroke Square. He talked with his private banker at J.P. Morgan about getting an Amex Black Card, the kind used by celebrities and billionaires. Only 32 years old, he worried about one of his sisters being jealous over his growing success and the lifestyle that came with it. Observing all this, Justo, though he didn't know the full details of what had happened at PetroSaudi, sensed he was not getting treated fairly. He believed Obaid was stiffing him by not fully paying his salary, as well as failing to reimburse travel and other costs. Adding insult to injury, Justo had to perform what he considered menial work, including organizing for Obaid and Joe Lowe to get exclusive credit cards from a Dubai bank. Fed up, in the spring of 2011, he decided to quit. But he wasn't just going to walk away. "Due to our history and all the projects I've taken part in over the years, I think an amicable separation is the best way for me to leave PetroSaudi and the other companies," he wrote Obaid in an email. "I'll wait for your confirmation that our collaboration is over from today, and that I'm to leave the office, and also that you will let me know how to get my severance pay." "You're a smartass. It's one thing to be a big mouth, but now you've blown everything up. Another word from you on that, and we're finished," Obaid replied. The Qanat meeting was a last-ditch attempt to reach terms. But Obaid insisted the amount agreed on in the bar be reduced again, this time to 4 million francs. It was a fateful decision. Justo received the 4 million Swiss francs in a severance agreement with PetroSaudi, but he felt shortchanged by 2.5 million Swiss francs. In the ensuing weeks, Obaid went around telling mutual friends that Justo was a loser who owed everything to PetroSaudi. Justo was furious when he heard the talk, so he came up with another plan. He knew something was not right about PetroSaudi's relationship with 1MDB, so he set about obtaining proof. To gain leverage in his dispute, Justo arranged to get a hold of a copy of PetroSaudi's computer servers from a PetroSaudi IT person. Amid the more than 140 gigabytes of data, including some 448,000 emails, documents, and other official papers, were details of the fraud that had transpired. He wouldn't do anything with the servers for more than 2 years, but when he did, it would cost Obaid and Mahoney more than a few million Swiss francs. As the drama unfolded in Europe, Low, unaware, was a continent away, busy shopping for a New York penthouse fit for a billionaire. And he was trying out a new story to explain his riches. Family wealth. Chapter 22. Penthouse with a View. New York, March 2011. Surrounded by an entourage of security, models, and friends, Lowe took in the views from penthouse 76B in the Time Warner Center on the southwest corner of Central Park. With trees and lawns filling the Florida Wall windows to the east, and the Hudson River stretching out to the west, the apartment boasted unfettered views of virtually the entire island of Manhattan. The 4,825-square-foot unit, with three bedrooms, a library, and a fish tank hanging from the ceiling in the Great Room, had once been the home of Jay-Z and Beyoncé, who rented it for $40,000 per month. As Lowe toured the apartment in the spring of 2011, he claimed to realtors to be picking up the place for a group of investors. To a member of the condominium board, however, Low purported to represent the Prime Minister of Malaysia. But it was really for him. The next year, he would transfer ownership of the Park Laurel apartment and his mansions in Los Angeles and London to Riza Aziz, Najib's stepson. The Time Warner penthouse, however, was his crown jewel, the residence that matched his aspirations to build a reputation in the United States as a movie mogul and serious investor. The acquisition of penthouse 76B was secured in June for $30.5 million in cash, one of the highest prices for the building and a price tag that made it among the most expensive apartments in the United States. With questions bubbling in the media about the source of his funds, Low took even greater precautions than in the past to mask his involvement. Over the years, Low had come up with creative reasons to justify his expenditures. Either rich Arab friends were paying, or he merely represented a group of investors, or Malaysia's prime minister. As it became difficult to deny his involvement, Low came to rely more on another explanation that he first had tried out on his Wharton and Harrow friends. The money issued from his grandfather, and Low simply was investing the family's billions. To make the story seem true, he needed to wash hundreds of millions of dollars through the bank accounts of family members, notably his father, Larry. Thin, with a narrow mustache and neatly parted hair, Larry Low was seen as a likable party guy back in Penang, though allegations he had cheated a former business partner trailed him. To send huge amounts of cash to his father, Low had to find a bank that wouldn't dig too deeply. Until this point, Low had managed to skirt banks' compliance departments, but it was hard work. With Deutsche Bank and Coutts, he was constantly forced to invent fake investment agreements to justify weighty movements of cash, and even had to fly to Zurich to explain deals. Low's ability to get this far was in part a result of the failings of compliance efforts at major financial institutions. Banks made money through letting transactions happen, not putting up roadblocks, and compliance officers were often pressured to turn a blind eye. But operating on this scale, Low was finding it harder and harder to hoodwink compliance. The primary U.S. law against money laundering is the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970, which requires institutions to keep records of financial transactions and report suspicious activity. A 1986 law made it illegal for banks to take part in or cover up money laundering. The Patriot Act of 2001, aimed at snuffing out terrorism financing after the September 11th attacks, forced banks to set up compliance programs and enhance due diligence on customers. And it allowed harsher financial penalties against banks that failed to stop shady transfers. By the late 2000s, though, banks were making too much money in the housing bubble to lose sleep over compliance. Few punishments were meted out, and as a result, banks and regulators didn't enforce these regulations all that stringently. More often than not, compliance departments were a weak appendage of a bank's ecosystem, isolated under legal affairs. The subprime crisis, starting in 2007, changed the picture. U.S. regulators had been caught napping, and the collapse of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, under the weight of bad mortgage loans, led to tighter scrutiny of banks' actions. That extended to anti-money laundering, as Treasury and the Justice Department began to hand out heftier punishments to transgressors. Wachovia Bank, in early 2010, agreed to pay $160 million in penalties for failing to report $8 billion in dodgy transfers. Around this time, the Justice Department was building its case against J.P. Morgan, where Bernie Madoff held his accounts, eventually leading to a record $2 billion fine under the Bank Secrecy Act. These actions were forcing Wall Street and major global banks in Europe and Japan to get their act together on compliance. What Low needed was a smaller bank, one that would be dependent on his business and took compliance even less seriously than Wall Street behemoths. He found it in a struggling Swiss bank called BSI, which was owned by Italian insurance group Assicurazioni Generali. Ironically, the bank had refused to handle the original Petrosaudi deal because of concerns over Low's role. But from late 2010, he started opening dozens of individual and corporate accounts at BSI's small Singapore branch. One of them, on June 28, 2011, was credited with $55 million from the Swiss account of Goodstar at Coutts. On the same day, Lowe sent $54.75 million from that account to one that Larry Lowe had recently opened, also with BSI in Singapore. From there, only hours later, $30 million was sent to Switzerland, digitally moving to Asia and back on the same day, landing in the account of another Lowe-controlled company at Rothschild Bank in Zurich. This was layering, the process of hiding money's origins through a complex maze of transactions, a crucial instrument in the money launderer's toolkit. In this case, Rothschild's compliance department could only see the money coming from Larry Lowe to Joe Lowe. By this simple process, Lowe created the impression of inherited money, flowing down through the generations. But BSI bankers could investigate under the hood and should have alerted authorities to the needless back-and-forth transactions between Lowe and his father. The likes of Coutts and Rothschild had failed to catch Lowe, but they had asked questions. Now Lowe was testing BSI's willingness to look the other way, a tryout the bank passed with flying colors, opening the doors to more lucrative business. The bank would become a crucial element in the plumbing of the 1MDB scheme as its scale escalated in the years ahead. From Rothschild, Lowe sent $27 million to one of his IOLTA accounts at Shearman, the U.S. law firm. Since 2009, Lowe had relied on these lawyer trust accounts for his myriad purchases, drawing on them to pay for gambling, parties, and yacht rentals, as well as to purchase multiple properties. Back then, Lowe had sent money directly to the IOLTA accounts from Goodstar. Now Lowe was taking greater precautions, sending money in a circuitous fashion into his lawyer accounts. These accounts were used to fund the purchase of the Time Warner penthouse, finalized in June 2011, as well as to pay Douglas Elliman a brokerage fee of $1.2 million. A Seychelles company, with 1MDB employee Seat Lee Lin as a signatory, was the initial purchaser of the Time Warner penthouse, but it assigned its rights to yet another shell firm controlled by Lowe. A notice to the Time Warner condominium board identified Larry Lowe as the occupant of the apartment, an attempt to buttress the image of a billionaire family. But it was Lowe who would live there, a suitably grandiose base in New York for one of the world's newest billionaires. Chapter 23. Switzerland of the East. Singapore, December 2009. How BSI came to be Lowe's bank of choice started with a fight. Back in late 2009, Hans-Peter Brunner was angry with his employer, Coutts International, the Zurich-based foreign arm of the 300-year-old British private bank, which has offices on the Strand and counts Queen Elizabeth among its clients. Brunner, a private banker in his 50s with short-cropped hair and a ruddy complexion, the consequence of a lifelong appreciation for vintage red wine, had taken a banking internship at age 15 in his native Switzerland rather than finishing high school and attending university. He spent a quarter century at Credit Suisse, where he learned the ropes of private banking, the industry of investing money for individuals with more than $1 million in liquid assets. By the 1990s, private banks were looking to expand in Asia, an area of fast economic growth, and Brunner moved to head Coutts' business in Singapore. The Southeast Asian city-state of 5 million people, located on a tropical island near the equator, was positioning itself as the Switzerland of the East, complete with banking secrecy laws modeled on Switzerland's. For a while, business flourished as Asia's economies powered ahead, generating scores of new millionaires. After the Asian financial crisis took hold in the late 1990s, slashing the stock holdings of rich Asians, Brunner was recalled to Switzerland to head the bank's international business. But he had developed a taste for the lifestyle in Asia, with its servants and drivers, and he was back in Singapore by 2006, residing in a modern apartment with a pool and outdoor whirlpool bath within walking distance of the city's botanical gardens. In the other direction was Orchard Road, a shopping and entertainment hub with restaurants and bars. The remuneration was another attraction. Brunner earned more than 1 million Swiss francs a year, with more in bonuses, received stipends for a driver and multiple free business class flights home, and enjoyed tax rates of only 15%. But he also had a problem. The global financial crisis had forced the British government to bail out the Royal Bank of Scotland, Coutts International's parent company. Now state-controlled, RBS set about cutting bonuses at Coutts and offered deferred payments in bonds instead of cash. Brunner was incensed. Senior management demanded his return to Switzerland. Hooked on the perks of living in Asia, and with another card up his sleeve, he declined to do so. For a year, Brunner had been holding talks with senior executives at BSI. Founded in the 19th century in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland, BSI had thrived for generations in a similar fashion to all Swiss banks, aiding wealthy Europeans and Americans who wanted to hide their cash in private accounts and evade the payment of taxes at home. For decades, rich Americans, Germans, French, and Italians would come to see their bankers in Switzerland, sometimes lugging suitcases of cash on the train to Geneva, Zurich, or in BSI's case, the bank's headquarters in a 1700s colonnaded mansion in the picturesque Alpine town of Lugano. Switzerland's stringent bank secrecy laws, which made it illegal for banks to divulge information about their clients, protected the business. By the mid-2000s, however, European nations and the United States had lost patience with Switzerland and began to pressure the country to hand over information on tax cheats. The European Union and Switzerland signed a treaty that forced Swiss banks to divulge information on accounts held by citizens of other European nations, or withhold a tax on customers who wished to remain anonymous. Surrounded by EU nations on all sides, and dependent on open border trade with its neighbors, Swiss politicians had no choice but to agree to this compromise. European clients began to look for other places to stash their money. Under this regulatory onslaught, the business model of small Swiss banks like BSI was imperiled. BSI had opened a Singapore office in 2005. But it had failed to make headway in Asia against better-known rivals like UBS and Credit Suisse. Brunner knew this, and he hatched an audacious plan that would change BSI's fortunes overnight. In late 2009, he reached an agreement with Alfredo Ghisi, the bank's Lugano-based chief executive, to jump ship with more than 100 Coutts employees, who were enticed by promises of salaries that were 20-40% higher and guaranteed bonuses for 3 years. The bank suddenly had over $2 billion in new customer money, more than tripling its assets under management in Asia, with Brunner as the new regional chief. "It was a marriage of convenience," said Kevin Swampile, a Malaysian banker who was among those who left Coutts for BSI. Ahead of the exodus, some Coutts bankers feared they might lose account holders who didn't want to shift their assets to BSI. Among the most nervous was Yak Yu Chi, a Singaporean banker in his 50s, who had a very important client, Joe Lowe. Yak was the private banker at Coutts for Larry Lowe, helping to invest the Penang resident's modest fortune. In 2006, just after Lowe had graduated from Wharton, Larry asked Yak to open an account for his son at Coutts in Singapore. Yak, who had spiky, thinning hair, graying at the sides, and often wore sunglasses, was a domineering personality who cowed co-workers. Often dismissive of others' views, he would complain to subordinates that women weren't cut out to become bankers, as they demanded time off for maternity leave. But he was tolerated by his bosses because he aced the only metric that counts in private banking. He brought in clients. The key to his success was a burgeoning relationship with Larry's son, Joe Lowe. In mid-2009, Lowe told Yak he would be helping a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund called 1MDB invest money. The idea was preposterous. Why would a state fund need to work through someone so young? And for what ends would it require the services of a bank specializing in private wealth of individuals? But Jacques agreed to help. He opened an account for Goodstar at Coutts, and he kept the firm's records. It was this account that ultimately received more than $1 billion in 1MDB money, forcing Lowe to make up a story to compliance staff at Coutts that Goodstar had an investment agreement with the Malaysian fund. Jacques knew Goodstar was controlled by Lowe, who explained that he was engaged in super-secretive government-to-government business, a line the banker swallowed without query. Lowe had found his perfect banker, tough but unquestioning. And when Jacques told him of his decision to move to BSI, a more obscure institution than Coutts, he decided to move his accounts over. Ecstatic at his accomplishment, Bruner boasted to a Bloomberg journalist about his plans to triple BSI's assets under management in Asia in just 5 years. Jacques already had proven pliable, and Lowe sensed BSI would not create trouble for him, especially if he helped turn Bruner's dream into a reality by channeling billions of dollars to the bank. It was part of a system Lowe was developing to identify institutions with weak governance and use that to his advantage. A few years later, he would ask a New York art dealer in an email to recommend him a lender with a quick and relaxed know-your-customer process. BSI would prove to be the ultimate example of this, a bank whose management, in the search for profit, asked few probing questions. From late 2010, Lowe relayed instructions to Jacques, now a managing director at BSI, to open a series of accounts in his name and those of scores of shell companies. There was an onboarding procedure, a checklist of simple know-your-customer bullet points that included items such as passport details, legal convictions, and the source of a customer's money. Lowe came up clean. It was at this point that he began laying the groundwork for his tale of family wealth. The June 2011 transfer of $55 million, some of which was used for the Time Warner purchase, was a test to see if BSI compliance staff would buy the story that this was family money. It worked, and Lowe began to send gushers of cash into his BSI accounts. The 1MDB fund also opened a slew of accounts with BSI, accounts which would receive billions of dollars in funds in the years ahead. The bank's compliance queried why a Malaysian sovereign fund would need a Swiss bank account. So, to ensure the buy-in of senior management at BSI, Lowe took precautions. He arranged for Jacques to set up a meeting in Lugano between senior 1MDB officials, including chief executive Sharol Halmy, and BSI's top management. It was yet another sign of Lowe's total control over the fund. The Malaysian executives flew to Switzerland, telling Bruner, BSI's chief executive, Gysi, and others to expect billions of dollars in business from the Sovereign Wealth Fund. Lowe's ability to arrange such gatherings gave him an aura of respectability, and despite his lack of a formal role at the fund, senior bankers like Gysi and Bruner stopped asking questions. Jacques was feted as BSI's star banker. "I wanted to personally thank you for your immense contribution, not only to our New Asia business, but to BSI Group as a whole," Gysi, the chief executive, wrote Jacques. His connection to Lowe made him exceedingly rich. Jacques began to take home around $5 million a year in salary and bonuses, more than five times his previous earnings, binding him to Lowe, the money and adulation too alluring to turn down. The bosses, too, began to reap the benefits of the relationship, as BSI became a force to be reckoned with in Singapore and globally. Bruner enjoyed hosting parties at his $7 million, 2,500-square-foot colonial-era townhouse in Singapore, close to his old apartment. The two-story, whitewashed building had been restored and furnished in the opulent style of a Chinese mandarin, with terracotta horses, statues of Chinese gods, and deep Persian carpets. According to Kevin Swampile, who became BSI's head of wealth management in Singapore, it was a lame duck management team that cared only about salaries, allowing lower-ranking bankers to act however they pleased. One of those given free rein was Yeo Jiawei. Chapter 24. Brazen Sky. Singapore, December 2011. With pointed eyebrows, pronounced cheeks, and a thick head of hair, Yeo Jo-wei, a 28-year-old Chinese-Singaporean banker at BSI, gave off a boyish air. But Yeo had become an expert in a dark corner of the global financial system. At BSI, he was a wealth manager, but his real expertise lay in an intricate knowledge of ways to help elite customers reduce tax bills. The bank's bread and butter, like many private banks in Singapore, was devising such strategies, largely for rich Indian and Southeast Asian clients. One method Yeo employed was to wash clients' money through investment funds in faraway places. Yeo's skills were perfectly suited to one of BSI's star clients, Joe Low. Low wanted a way to send money through multiple accounts to keep its origins secret, and Yeo had promised to deliver. Instead of dealing with mundane tax evasion, Low told Yeo he would have a new assignment, secret government work. Like many people who brushed up against the Malaysian, Yeo was intrigued and flattered. He set about doing what Low wanted. In December 2011, Yeo set up a meeting in Singapore with Jose Renato Carvalho Pinto, a Brazilian relationship manager at Amicorp Group, a small financial firm. Yeo described to Pinto how BSI was doing work involving Malaysian and Middle Eastern investment funds and needed Amicorp to set up a series of fund structures. Pinto was interested. Amicorp was co-founded by a Dutch financier named Twan Knipping, who had worked for years as a financier in Curaçao, a sun-swept Caribbean island that was formerly a colony of the Netherlands, before settling in Singapore. Knipping had an eclectic curriculum vitae. He'd worked for a Venezuelan bank, held an interest in a South African aloe vera drinks company, and authored a book on ethical investing. One of his main areas of expertise was Curaçao, which in the 1970s and 1980s emerged as a major offshore center. It also got a name as a transshipment point for drugs from South America to enter the United States, and a haven to stash dirty cash, regularly landing Curaçao on the U.S. State Department's list of major money laundering countries. Knipping's company helped hedge funds and other financial firms run their day-to-day business, calculating the value of investments, for instance, or clearing trades. But like many smaller trust companies, Amicorp did a bit of everything, and this included administering small investment funds in Curaçao that were often used by rich Asians to discreetly move money around. In the meeting, Yeo explained how BSI needed Amicorp's help to set up an investment fund structure for Malaysian fund 1MDB. And Pinto got to work. The first transaction, for $100 million, went from a BSI account controlled by 1MDB into an Amicorp-administered mutual fund in Curaçao. But it wasn't a usual mutual fund, the kind in which a manager pools cash from mom-and-pop investors, using it to buy stocks and bonds. Sure, this entity, Enterprise Emerging Market Fund, took cash from multiple investors, but the structure masked one major difference from a plain vanilla mutual fund. It also comprised segregated portfolios that took cash from only one client before investing in another asset. It was a simple way to wash a client's money through what looked like a mutual fund. In other words, cash coming out the other side appeared to be a transfer from a mutual fund. This was exactly what happened with the $100 million, which Enterprise Emerging Market Fund promptly sent to a shell company controlled by Fat Eric, Low's associate, and increasingly an important nominee for his many companies. Yeo never made clear the business reason for the transfer. It was unclear why a state fund such as 1MDB would use such secretive financial structures, but Pinto didn't pry, as BSI had vouched for 1MDB. As Kevin Swampile, Yeo's boss, put it, there was only a semblance of compliance at these funds. In the next couple of years, Amicorp would set up $1.5 billion of such structures for 1MDB, Low and his family. Here was a legal, if highly questionable, way to disguise money flows. In the earlier stages, Low had been content to send cash straight from Goodstar to his U.S. law trust accounts with Shearman and Sterling. or more recently, into his accounts at BSI. But the media spotlight on his partying and the compliance hassles were making him more paranoid. By using an intermediary step like the Curaçao Fund, Lowe hoped to cover over any footprints. Yo had delivered, and Lowe began to trust him. As he moved deeper into Lowe's orbit, Yo's self-regard for his own skills grew, and he expressed disdain for bankers at BSI who didn't deal directly with such powerful clients. Like BSI itself, Yo had proven himself an amenable fit for Joe Lowe, and Lowe would soon turn to the young banker again. The 1MDB fund still had to account for the $1.8 billion it claimed to have lent to PetroSaudi. Of this, Lowe and his conspirators had taken the lion's share, and now he needed Yo to help make the debt go away. Earlier, the fund's executives had attempted to get Tim Leissner of Goldman to find a bank that would value the oil drill ships, about the only asset PetroSaudi had acquired with 1MDB's money, at an inflated price of $1 billion. The idea was for 1MDB to take over those assets and, in return, write down the debt. Although he likely did not know the full picture, Leissner got Lazard, the U.S. investment bank, to take a look at the drill ships, but it couldn't come up with a valuation anywhere near high enough to make this plan work. Instead, Yo got to work on a convoluted set of transactions that was pure financial trickery. Essentially, 1MDB would swap a large portion of its debt for a stake in a PetroSaudi subsidiary that owns the drill ships, even though they were worth nothing like the $1.8 billion that 1MDB was owed. Yo then arranged for 1MDB to sell that stake to Bridge Partners International, which was controlled by a Hong Kong financier named Lobo Lee. A long-distance triathlete, who was middle-aged but kept fit cycling Hong Kong's mountainous terrain, Lee was just another one of the many small-time fund managers in the Caribbean, Hong Kong, Bangkok, and Singapore, who created arcane structures for a fee, without querying the need for such complexity. By remaining ignorant of the full terms, they were the cogs that allowed the money laundering machine to keep humming along. Instead of paying in cash, Bridge Partners set up a Cayman Islands investment fund, effectively giving 1MDB units in the fund in return for the stake. The fund, called Bridge Global, had only one client, 1MDB, and hadn't even registered with authorities in the Cayman Islands for permission to make investments. Magically, 1MDB now claimed in its financial statements the Bridge Global investment was worth $2.3 billion, a profit of $500 million on the money it had lent to PetroSaudi. The 1MDB fund set up a new subsidiary called Brazen Sky, which opened a bank account with BSI to hold the units. It was nothing but a facade. There was no cash there, only fund units, supposedly the profits from selling a stake in two almost worthless oil drill ships. On paper, however, 1MDB could claim it had made a profit, and Lowe conspired to get it past auditors. Pressed by accountants at KPMG, Yo gave the impression the Bridge Global Fund units were backed by cash. The financial engineering had helped disguise the truth, and KPMG carried on with its audit. But the problem hadn't gone away, and the firm's accountants would not prove that easy to con the following year. Yo must have known what BSI was doing was ropey, and so he set up a scheme with his boss, Kevin Swampile, to profit himself. The 1MDB fund had agreed to pay $4 million annually to Bridge Global and $12 million to BSI for helping set up the Cayman Islands arrangement. But Yo was managing the process, and Lobo Lee didn't know the full details. So Yo persuaded the Hong Kong fund manager to settle for $500,000. And Yo and Swampile funneled off millions of dollars to their personal accounts. The seemingly massive amount now in 1MDB's Brazen Sky account at BSI worried Hans-Peter Brunner, the bank's chief executive in the region. BSI's Singapore branch suddenly appeared to have billions of dollars in new deposits, and Brunner feared the Monetary Authority of Singapore, Singapore's central bank, would want an explanation. After a period of fast growth in its private banking industry, the city-state was facing pressure to do more to impede money laundering. Singapore's private banking industry was booming, managing $1 trillion in assets, a third of Switzerland's total, but still making it one of the largest offshore centers on the planet. The city-state already had a reputation as a place for corrupt Indonesians, Chinese, and Malaysians to hide money. Now, it was attracting more European and U.S. clients trying to escape the increased scrutiny from Western regulators, who were fed up with tax cheats. The Financial Action Task Force, the Paris-based group which sets anti-money laundering standards, recently had singled Singapore out for failing to prosecute more dirty money cases. So, Bruner later set up a meeting with Singapore's central bank, during which he gave a presentation on Brazen Sky and the bank's other 1MDB-related business. But he did not go into detail, instead giving a simple overview and stressing this was the business of an official Malaysian government fund. Bruner's stewardship of BSI would cost him and imperil the bank's very existence. But Lo, at least for now, had overcome another complication and was readying for the next phase of his scheme. This time, Tim Leissner of Goldman wouldn't miss out. Chapter 25. Goldman and the Sheikh. The Second Heist. Abu Dhabi, March 2012. In early March, Tim Leissner flew into Abu Dhabi, the humid Persian Gulf Emirate, for a rare meeting with one of the world's richest people, Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed. As one of 19 children of the founder of the UAE, the Sheikh was worth an estimated $40 billion, and perhaps best known for his ownership of Manchester City Football Club. His grandparents' generation had been born penniless, living as date farmers, camel rearers, and pearl fishermen. But the discovery of oil in the late 1950s had changed their fortunes. Obtaining a sit-down meeting with Sheikh Mansour was almost unheard of, even for the most heavyweight investors. The Sheikh's power derived not only from his personal fortune, but also his role as chairman of the International Petroleum Investment Company, a $70 billion sovereign wealth fund. IPIC, financed by huge amounts of debt, recently had become a global investment force. It had even taken a stake in Barclays Bank of the UK during the financial crisis. Wall Street bankers were often seen sniffing for deals at IPIC, which was in the process of building a futuristic modern headquarters, a series of domino-thin skyscrapers, one shorter than the next, which would offer panoramic views of Abu Dhabi's main island and the expanse of the Persian Gulf. But few had met Sheikh Mansour. Leissner was among the chosen, thanks to Lo's newfound closeness with Kadem Al-Kubaisi, an aide to the Sheikh. In a few days, the Goldman banker would be boasting to colleagues in Asia about his unparalleled access in the Middle East, although he was careful not to play up Lo's role in making this happen. But right now, he needed to get the Sheikh to agree to a deal that could change his fortunes. He was on the cusp of winning the mega 1MDB business, for which he had spent years laying the groundwork. In his meeting with the Sheikh, Leissner was accompanied by Lo, who also had traveled to the Emirate. After pleasantries, the group got down to discussing the outlines of the deal. The Wall Street Bank was preparing to sell a total of $3.5 billion in bonds for the 1MDB fund to finance the purchase of coal-fired power plants in Malaysia and overseas. The plan was for 1MDB to package these facilities, as well as some new plants, into one company and IPO the shares on Malaysia's stock exchange. The listing could earn 1MDB around $5 billion, as the power plants put under one entity would be worth a lot more. The problem was that 1MDB had never issued a U.S. dollar bond to international investors, and it had no credit rating. So Goldman was suggesting it ask IPIC, a sovereign entity with a strong credit rating, to guarantee the issue. That would put investors at ease, giving them confidence that 1MDB would be able to repay the debt, whatever the circumstances. In return for its guarantee, IPIC would acquire the rights to buy a stake in the listed power company at a favorable price. This was Lowe's latest blueprint for 1MDB, a way for the fund to enter the power generation business, make some money, and hopefully paper over losses. But there were many oddities in the plan. Why would a Malaysian state fund seek a guarantee from a similar fund of another country? Why didn't Malaysia's government just offer a sovereign guarantee for the debt? Indeed, Leisner's colleagues at Goldman's Middle Eastern headquarters in Dubai, who did regular business with IPIC, found the idea preposterous and declined to get involved. Even IPIC's own finance director raised questions about why IPIC would put itself at risk over another fund's business, one with no track record at that, but was outranked. The Sheikh, a youthful 41-year-old with a toothy grin, had the final say at IPIC. After Leisner and Lowe made their presentations, Sheikh Mansour gave the go-ahead. The proposal for IPIC to guarantee the Malaysian fund's bonds may have looked strange, but it was an artificial construct, purely aimed at creating an excuse to divert more than $1 billion from 1MDB. Lowe had put the scheme together with Al-Kubaisi, who was also the managing director of IPIC. They had gotten to know each other on the failed Claridge's bid, and Lowe had brokered a deal for Abar, an IPIC subsidiary, to buy a Malaysian bank. That deal had lost money for Al-Kubaisi, but now Lowe was about to repay him many times over. And IPIC's guarantee was the linchpin of the plan. With gelled back hair and a bodybuilder's physique, the result of 2 hours a day pumping iron, the 41-year-old Al-Kubaisi was a striking figure. The Al-Kubaisi family had married into the ruling Al-Nayans a generation earlier, a family tie that had helped his career. After working for the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, the Emirates' most well-known and largest sovereign wealth fund, he had become managing director of IPIC in 2007. But his real power lay as Sheikh Mansour's trusted dealmaker. There was another attraction to Al-Kubaisi. He had a reputation for taking kickbacks on deals, making him incredibly rich. Lowe had spent hundreds of millions on parties, mansions, and trophy investments like the L'Hermitage Hotel, not to mention secret payments to his co-conspirators. Yet he craved greater riches. He wasn't happy with a smattering of low-profile deals in real estate. He wanted to become a genuine mogul. The Wolf of Wall Street was slated to kick off filming in the second half of 2012, and Lowe still didn't have financing in place. He needed more cash, and he sensed Al-Kubaisi could deliver it, for a price. Through his relationship with Sheikh Mansour, Al-Kubaisi was one of the most powerful men in the Emirate. Even in the brash and showy UAE, Al-Kubaisi struck bankers as an unparalleled egoist, traveling with a retinue of Egyptian security guards and embossing his initials, KAQ, on cigars, drink coasters, boxes of tissues, and even his collection of high-end cars worth tens of millions of euros, which he kept in a storage facility in Geneva and at his villas in the south of France. In Abu Dhabi, Al-Kubaisi wore the traditional Emirati cloak and head covering, and had a family home, a sprawling villa, where his wife and four children lived. But like many rich Emiratis, he conducted a different life overseas. At his villa on the Côte d'Azur, with Bugattis and Ferraris parked outside, he partied with models, and he had a younger Moroccan wife in Paris. When abroad, he traded in traditional Emirati dress for tight-fitting t-shirts, including one with a montage of images of Al Pacino's Tony Montana from the 1983 film Scarface. Once, when an executive showed up to Al-Kubaisi's mansion in France to discuss business, he answered the door wearing a skimpy swimsuit, while women in bikinis lingered in the background. The Sheikh oversaw IPIC, and he liked to have the final say on major deals, like this burgeoning business with 1MDB. But he also delegated incredible powers to Al-Kubaisi, who had the ability to greenlight acquisitions without board approval. With a single execution of his wide, sharp signature, he could okay a multi-billion dollar deal on behalf of the fund. Kadem was the only man in the world who you could call with a $10 billion deal and he'd just say yay or nay. He thought he was God, said one financier. In return, Al-Kubaisi ensured that Sheikh Mansour remained flush with funds to pay for a lifestyle that required vast expenditures. Salaries for dozens of staff, the cost of maintaining houses, boats, cars, and planes around the globe. IPIC had been founded in 1984 to invest in oil-related companies. But with Al-Kubaisi at its helm, the fund and its subsidiary, Abar Investments, had engaged in a spending spree. Most famously, its bailout, alongside Qatar, of Barclays in 2008, which saved the bank from a government takeover, but also the acquisitions of minority stakes in Daimler-Benz, UniCredit, Virgin Galactic, and other companies. All of them major deals. The boundaries between IPIC, a state fund, and the Sheikh's personal business empire were not always sharply drawn. In the case of the Barclays acquisition, for instance, British regulators believed Sheikh Mansour was putting in the money, when in fact the funds came from IPIC. Although he had not invested any personal cash, Barclays issued warrants to the Sheikh as part of the deal, allowing him to buy shares in the bank at a low price. He eventually made more than $1 billion in profit, at no risk to his own funds. Abar's books contained a tangle of transactions with companies tied to Sheikh Mansour, involving land and loans in the billions of dollars. In addition to his day job, Al-Kubaisi oversaw these private businesses, and his privileged position, close to the Al-Nayans, gave him free rein to feather his own nest. In a 2009 lawsuit filed in the United States, two businessmen claimed Al-Kubaisi had asked for $300 million in kickbacks during a failed bid to take over the Four Seasons hotel chain. The plaintiffs later withdrew the suit. Behind his brash demeanor, Al-Kubaisi had a problem. Unlike ADIA, which could rely on payments from the state's oil profits, IPIC was fueled mainly by debt. By 2012, it had $19 billion in borrowings, and only the Abu Dhabi government's 100% ownership ensured its debt was awarded investment-grade credit ratings. The fund's image as a major investor, in fact, was partly a mirage. After the crisis, when Al-Kubaisi saw an opportunity to buy stakes in big Western companies and banks, he turned to Wall Street for financing. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and others made huge profits arranging derivatives financing for IPIC, just another naive emerging market sovereign wealth fund, helping to make up for subdued markets and economies in the West. But it was becoming harder for Al-Kubaisi to raise money from Wall Street. In 2011, the de facto ruler of the UAE, Sheikh Mansour's brother, Mohammed bin Zayed, had ordered all debt issuances to go through a central authority to avoid a repeat of the Dubai debt crisis, in which state entities overborrowed and had to be bailed out by the UAE government to the tune of $20 billion. As he was searching for new ways to keep the cash flowing, Al-Kubaisi came into contact with Joe Lo, who boasted he could sign multi-billion dollar deals involving the 1MDB fund. Like Al-Kubaisi, Lo was a young, unaccountable figure who, through relations with the truly powerful, controlled billions of dollars. Lo had brokered Abar's investment in RHB, the Malaysian bank, which had lost money, but his latest proposal would more than make up for that debacle. IPIC agreed to guarantee the 1MDB bonds, and Goldman set about arranging the issue. Chapter 26. Bilking the State. New York, March 2012. At Goldman's global headquarters at 200 West Street in downtown Manhattan, a 44-story skyscraper on the Hudson completed just after the financial crisis, senior bankers were growing concerned over this business in faraway Malaysia. But the unorthodox deal-making had a powerful supporter, President Gary Cohn. Bald, with a pointed skull and furrows across his brow, the 51-year-old banker was a formidable presence. He was aggressive and blunt, a personality forged on Goldman's trading floors, where he had launched his career alongside Lloyd Blankfein. When his friend rose to chief executive, Cohn had taken the number two job and had remained a loyal lieutenant, helping defend the company's pre-crisis bet against the housing market. Now, with Western economic activities subdued, Cohn was spearheading a drive to do more deals with sovereign wealth funds in emerging markets. And that led him